prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we review underseen horror movies, specifically those with fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Erica.
And I'm Lance.
And we have a guest this episode. Jonathan from the new podcast, Twitch of the Death Nerve, is here.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Welcome, John.
Do you want to tell everyone about Twitch of the Death Nerve?
Sure. It's a podcast with me and my friends Charles and Sam, and we cover weird movies. Unlike my last one where we just did horror movies, we kind of branch out a bit, which is a welcomed relief for me.
Can you be more specific what you mean by weird movies?
Just, you know, your cult exploitation movies.
Throwing around the term like psychotronic.
Yes, you know? Yeah.
What are some movies that you guys have covered so far?
We've done Fulci's The Gates of Hell, which is one of the best movies ever made. Shogun Assassin, The Untold Story. Then we did an episode where we just talked about animal attacks movies in general, which is a wonderful genre. And soon we're going to be doing Frankenstein Created Woman, which is one of my favorite Hammer movies.
So one of your co-hosts, Sam, you mentioned, so she was our guest for Patrick Still Lives, for listeners who are finding the connection for that.
Another wonderful movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
So before we get into our movie for this episode, we've got a couple of things. In one of our episodes during Shawgust, first of all, I want to thank everyone for the feedback we got during that month. We had a lot of people reach out to us and really enjoyed that content that month. So that was fun to hear from everybody. And, you know, feel free to reach out for other stuff too, not just Shawgust, just saying. Henry Monkey on Instagram actually messaged us because, Lance, you had mentioned wanting some sort of Shaw Brothers book.
Right, some sort of biography out there, anything you can find.
So he messaged about a couple of things, and I actually have one of these books, and I haven't read through the whole thing, so I didn't even realize there was a Shaw Brothers chapter in it, which is More Sex, Better Zen, Faster Bullets, The Encyclopedia of Hong Kong Cinema. And I thumbed through, and it's a chapter, which does not do Shaw Brothers justice. So.
Right, but it's something.
Yeah, it's a good book, just covering a lot of Hong Kong movies, but he did also mention China Forever, the Shaw Brothers, and Diasporic Cinema, but apparently he said he's waiting on a copy of that until it's drastically reduced in price. So he also did mention, not book-wise, but the two Hex sequels. Not very good. So, I mean, I'll probably still watch them. I know they're more comedy, but...
Yeah, I mean, the first one's so good, I feel like I need to complete the collection.
Right.
At some point. Just
at some point.
So yeah, I appreciate that. I'm going to check out those books.
And then the other thing before we get into our film is we are going to be doing our Horror Gives Back charity movie watching challenge again this year. And so we will be posting what all the categories that we're putting together for that are, but we did want to give listeners a heads up ahead of time so that if you want to start planning, you can. So just as a reminder, or for folks who are new to Horror Gives Back, the core of the challenge itself is for you to donate per horror movie that you watch in October to charity. So we have a list together of different categories, but you don't have to necessarily follow our list. We know a lot of people create their own lists or follow other lists. You can follow ours. That's fine. Lance and I are going to be doing that. It's up to you. But the point of it is to donate to charity. So last year, we basically said, just donate to any charity that you want. This year, we want to try and make it a little bit more organized and have just one charity where people can donate to. And we think one that everyone can really get behind is the Trevor Project.
Yeah.
So we're going to have a fundraising page set up on that. So once you have finished watching all your movies and counted them up, you can donate $1 per movie or $2, you know, if you're, you know, money bags, or more if you want, to that charity through that link. And we'll have that in our in our profiles on Twitter and Instagram and wherever else. It'll be easy to find. All right. And so, again, like I mentioned, we'll be posting what all the categories are on our Twitter and Instagram and Facebook pages. But if anyone wants to start planning early, we're going to walk through our categories really quickly and what they are. So different category for each day of the month. And these can definitely be played fast and loose. I know I definitely do that a lot. So starting on October 1st, Roger Corman. October 2nd is sequel. October 3rd, anthology. October 4th, insects. October 5th, animals. October 6th, Italy. October 7th, made for TV. October 8th, Christopher Young. So any movie any horror movie, rather, that has a Christopher Young score. October 9th, Bleeding Skull. So you could do anything that maybe Bleeding Skull has reviewed on their website, or a movie that is in either their 80s or 90s trash horror books. Lance has a list of the 90s one on his Letterboxd profile, and Bleeding Skull has one for the 80s book. So we'll be posting links to those so that you can find those for quick reference. But if you're on Letterboxd already, you can find those. And October 10th, Hail Satan. October 11th, Mexico. October 12th, Scarecrow. October 13th, 1980s. October 14th, female directed. October 15th, Hong Kong. And Lance, you want to tell everyone the rest?
Yeah, I'll do that next half. October 16th is Slasher. October 17th, it's my birthday, everybody, by the way. Just heads up. It's the Unsung Horrors Rule. So that means any horror movies that have under 1,000 views on Letterboxd. October 18th is Ken Foray. The 19th is Vampires. Then October 20th, we're going Giallo. The 21st, Universal Horror. October 22nd, Stephen King. A lot of movies there.
Yeah.
The 23rd is Physical Media. So if you don't own a horror movie on Blu-ray or DVD, buy one. Or I guess you could just get a digital copy too. I mean. Again, it's all open to however you interpret it.
We have any listeners who don't have physical copy of a horror movie.
You can borrow one.
That's true.
Yes. Yeah. Support your local library.
Or your buddy, Erica, who has thousands of movies on herself.
Go to a thrift store. Yeah. Friday 13th, part 3 VHS tape will be there or something. Oh, yeah. That's true.
Yeah. It'll be a DVD or something. But yeah.
Some full moon straight to video movie.
There you go.
Yeah.
You can't go wrong with Full Moon. I actually wanted a category Full Moon in a thing, but
vetoed
immediately. Okay, the 24th, we're going LGBTQ. October 25th is Daria Nicolodi. The 26th is 70s Horror. October 27th, Across the Pond.
Yeah, so I guess, if we have listeners who are across the pond, that could apply to them, like you watch an American or Canadian horror movie.
Yeah.
But for us, that's like...
It's wherever you are geographically, so you can pick whatever works for you for all our international listeners. The 28th is Barbara Steele. Then the 29th, it's Hammer Time. Hammer Horror, baby. The 30th is Haunted House. And like last year... Halloween, October 31st, is Free Space, so pick whatever you want. I have a lot of, I'm sure all of us have Halloween staples that we watch every year. Yeah. So, yeah, and that is our complete list for Horror Gives Back.
So we'll be posting that list soon, but if for whatever reason you want to get your hands on it earlier than that, feel free to message us. I'm happy to send that your way. All right, so let's get into the movie for this episode. We are covering Friday the 13th, The Orphan. And this is also known as just The Orphan and Betrayal. As of this recording, it has 136 views on Letterboxd. So The Orphan is about young David, who has lost his parents in a murder-suicide, and now his aunt has moved in to take care of him. David is trying to establish his identity with the help of his father's traveling companion, Akeem. But his oppressive aunt is doing everything to stifle him. David soon reaches a breaking point and turns to violence. The Orphan, or Friday the 13th Orphan, was written and directed by John Ballard. This is his only film besides a short student film that he made, described as Buñuelish, or Luis Buñuel, as well as a documentary about Jorge Luis Borges. When he was in college at Harvard, he actually studied psychology, and his thesis was on the subject of role models and identity, which I feel like kind of comes through in this movie.
Strongly.
I think in his interview with Stephen Thrower, and full disclosure, a lot of the facts that I'm going to share about this movie and the director come directly from Stephen Thrower's book, Nightmare USA, where he's got a write-up about this, and including an interview with John Ballard. But so Ballard had actually described this movie as being psychologically autobiographical. So it definitely comes through in this.
What kind of childhood did he have?
I don't know. I don't think Thrower got too far.
Yeah.
Ballard has also cited Bergman, Cassavetes, and Polanski as influences. I think we can see that in this movie.
Definitely Repulsion.
Yeah. Mm. I think one of the ones he specifically cited was Bergman's Persona, when there's that scene of him putting the broken mirror pieces together with the father.
Right.
And fun fact, he was actually one of three directors in final contention to direct The Exorcist.
Wow. Didn't he say something like it didn't interest him, or he wasn't very interested by the story?
I think he said he wanted to take it in a different direction. But John, you mentioned that Blatty was pushing for Friedkin.
Yeah. From the get-go, William Peter Blatty wanted Friedkin. There's a funny story about how they met, where before William Friedkin was William Friedkin, this was like when he was making like the Sonny and Cher movie. He was brought into this office to do a movie for this guy who was like a big TV star. And he read the script and he told the guy, he's like, yeah, I would love to make this, but the script is terrible. Like, I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy. And the guy freaked out and kicked him out of the office. So Friedkin's like, I guess I'm not getting that job. And as he's walking to his car, this guy comes up and he's like, yeah, I was in that office. I'm the guy who wrote the script, and I agree it was really terrible, you know, but I liked how you stuck to your guns. And that guy turned out to be William Peter Blatty. And when he was working on The Exorcist, I think, like, because it was a big bestseller from the get-go, like, part of the agreement for the movie adaptation was he got like director choice, and he had to fight for William Friedkin. Even though he got like choice, it was sort of like still a bargaining thing.
Yeah. Right, with the studios and stuff, yeah.
And then history was made.
All right, so speaking of film adaptations, this was actually loosely, but not too loosely, based on a short story called Sredni Vashtar, written by Hector Hewman Rowe, pen name Saki. Lance, I saw you watched a couple of the short
adaptations. I did. I read the story, too.
It's really short.
Yeah, it's like 1,800 words, maybe, mm-hmm. 10 paragraphs. But yeah, there were two adaptations, one from 1940, which was a short, I think it was about 11 minutes. Yeah, it's narrated by the director David Bradley, and this one's labeled a straight-up horror film. Mm-hmm. It was filmed in black and white, you know, obviously. And the narration actually reminded me, after coming off all these bleeding skull 90s trash horror movies, it reminded me of like a shot on video kind of feel, which was very appealing, you know, when I turned it on. Yeah, this one, I mean, the two adaptations I saw were pretty much just lifted straight from the short story. They use the names Sredni Vashtar, and the aunt is, she's actually his David's cousin. Well, the child's name is Conrad in these. The 1940s worth, I mean, both are on YouTube. I would check it out for sure. But the 1981 version, directed by Andrew Birkin, which apparently was nominated for an Oscar for a short film in 1981. But that one's really good. That one was about 28 minutes long. And a lot of similarities to, I feel like Ballard might have lifted more from that short than the actual story itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, the toast comes up in both, actually. and in both of the shorts, the main character, David, who we'll get to, is straight off the bat, he's sickly. The doctor gives him about 5 years to live, which I don't think Ballard really gets into too much in his version. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's mainly about a sickly kid who's just getting lost in his imagination. And then obviously grieving with his father and his mother passing away. But I do recommend him, yeah.
I remember reading that like there was a doctor's appointment scene that was cut initially. Mm-hmm. that might be some of the sickliness is in that part.
Yeah, I think that's listed in one of the deleted scenes.
Yeah.
So one of the other points that came up in the interview with John Ballard in Thriller's book was the composer for this. It was almost Leonard Cohen, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
That was kind of a blown.
It was just for like the title track or something, right?
Well, I Need to Live Alone Again, which is, they went with Janice Ian, who apparently was, I guess, popular at the time. I'm not familiar with her.
I'm not either. I didn't really care for the song. I thought it was super cheesy, but the score itself, did you have any thoughts about?
I don't know if there was a lot of traditional music used. Like in the very beginning, it seems like most of the montage, like scenes of him, like, usually when he's having like a happy childhood or a happy time, it's this weird, like sped up kind of waltzy, fanatical piano beating. I found most of the songs and the scores just to be kind of ill-fitted and didn't really, I guess it fits with the movie because everything's kind of ill-fitting in this movie, but the music to me sound very made for TV.
Yeah. The first time I watched it, I was kind of annoyed by it. And then after I read Thrower's write-up and learned that Leonard Cohen was almost the composer, then all I could think of, this should have been scored by Leonard Cohen.
Yeah, I love Leonard Cohen. I got to see him twice before he passed, which was, I love the man. So when I read that, I was like, you fucking blew it. Like, this is, that's all I could think of. And it would have fit perfectly because there is this hard focused relation. There's this focus on this father son relationship. So Leonard Cohen with his deep voice, I mean, it wasn't that deep as it was, in 1978, as it was when, in the '90s and stuff, but that would have fit better than the, I need to live alone again. Like, very good. Yeah. That bothered me when I read that.
Editing was by director John Ballard and Ralph Rosenblum, but the assistant editor was Susan Morse, who also worked on a lot of Woody Allen projects as well as The Warriors.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
So getting into the production of this, this actually started filming in 1968 under the title Killers of the Dream, and about 75% of the film was completed that year. However, he never got around to really finishing it, either for money issues or just sort of temporarily losing interest in it. It was eventually released on video with a copyright of 1977, which if you watch it on YouTube, you'll see that it's titled The Orphan, copyright 1977, though the release dates online vary to 1978, 1979. It actually opened at the 1978 Miami Film Festival. So like I mentioned, in 1977, it was still unfinished. Ballard began working with these two women who got more money together for him to finish it, but they also ended up making sure that a lot of the blood and sex was cut out of it due to their quote-unquote puritanical nature. Before they stepped in, the film was 110 minutes long. The version that is out there now is down to just under 80 minutes. So the version on YouTube calls itself the rare extended cut. There's only one version out there. It's that one that is out there. I don't know, because it didn't mention in Thrower's write-up, if all the deleted scenes and everything else that were cut when those two women stepped in are still available, so that if this ever did see a release, if there would be a director's cut,
right,
that could potentially be a little less disjointed and have more of the horror elements in there. But so one other thing that the two women who became involved in 1977 did was they changed the title from Betrayal to Friday the 13th, Orphan, as a gimmick. Although, like I mentioned when I introduced this movie last episode, or in Corpse Mania, Friday the 13th has absolutely nothing to do with this film.
Well, yeah, and it's funny, too, that these two women would want to sell it or, market it as a horror when they themselves seem to have a big contribution of pulling out all the horror elements. So
money.
Yeah, it's all about the money. And there, I had read too that they were mothers and didn't want their children, so to speak, see this type of stuff in movies. So
right,
very annoying.
Yeah.
What the fuck is wrong with people? Like, really, it's just like.
So it was released initially as Friday the 13th, Orphan, but come 1980, the producers of the Voorhees Friday the 13th they want their own holiday connected gimmick horror movie. And so they end up coming to Ballard and essentially buying the title off of him. So this is now officially The Orphan, but if you see key art for it, or if you happen to have a VHS of it, it's got the Friday the 13th calendar on it. I do know the VHS just does say The Orphan, so that's a big version on YouTube, but I imagine at the Miami Film Festival, it would have said Friday the 13th, The Orphan. So getting into the cast, the star of the film is young Mark Owens as David. This is his only film. He was 10 when they began shooting and 17 when they finally finished.
That's wild.
So there's actually, I think like the birthday scene flashback, that's one of his younger brothers playing him because that was shot later on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I read that they used his voice, or his younger brother's voice as well. So yeah, everybody losing their mind over like Linklater's Boyhood. Come on, Ballard did it first.
Right.
So yeah, like I mentioned, this is his only film. The only other credit he has on IMDb is an episode of Johnny Carson in 1988, which I looked high and low and I couldn't find this because there's only parts of Johnny Carson episodes out there. Mm-hmm. And so the episode that he was on, I don't even know why he was on it.
Must have been like a sketch or something.
I don't know. But it was Robert Goulet was on the episode. And so the only thing you can find is the Robert Goulet performance from that Johnny Carson episode.
That's good.
Yeah. Peggy Fiore as Aunt Martha, whom the producer said was a narcoleptic.
Yeah.
Which I thought was funny.
Which one's a narcoleptic? Is that when you fall asleep?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's funny. Yeah, that to wake her up.
It's very weird. In between takes.
So Peggy was also in Ken Russell's Crimes of Passion, 1984. That has an Arrow release. Highly recommend that. It's a lot of fun. She was in The Witch Who Came from the Sea, 1976.
Oh, that's a great movie.
Yeah. She was also in a TV movie that I watched last year starring Cloris Leachman called Someone I Touched, which is about the dangers of syphilis and making sure that if you contract an STD, you better tell everyone.
Oh, I remember you telling me about that movie. That sounded great.
Yeah, young Cloris Leachman could get it.
Really?
The title, too.
Yeah. David's companion through about half of this movie is one of his father's traveling friends named Akeen. He's played by Afolabi Ajayi. This is also his only film. He actually died after most of his scenes were shot and a double was used in some of the scenes. Stanley Church plays Dr. Thompson. Joanna Miles is, she's David's mother. And then Don White plays David's father. Also, no other interesting acting credits. So we will get into our thoughts about this film right after this promo from our network.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal: providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
A cycle of tragedy destroys a family and leaves a little boy an orphan.
Happy birthday, David.
Daddy. David, how did your mother die?
Now you're an orphan.
I'm Martha.
Your Aunt Martha.
I'm your aunt, David, and I'm going to be your friend.
Isolation and hatred breed a world of fantasy. A nightmare of vengeance and violence begins, and on a fateful Friday the 13th, the orphan arises to kill.
So John, I wanted to ask you, so I mentioned when I introduced this for Corpse Mania, that this movie is going to try a lot of people's patience. It's not great, but I wanted to cover it primarily because of Stephen Thrower's write-up about this film. But you had mentioned, because I have not read Stephen Thrower's book cover to cover. The thing is massive.
Right.
It's more of a reference book. It's like, I want to learn about this movie. I'm going to look it up. But you had mentioned that Stephen Thrower has a hard-on for movies like this.
Yeah, every movie where it's like one single dude slowly losing his mind. He just has a thing. I remember him writing that, like, he thinks Martin is the greatest American horror movie, which is a great movie. And then if you read his write-up on Don't Go in the House, which is another great movie, same thing. It's just this guy in a house slowly burning women to death. And so when I watched this movie, I was like, oh, yeah, I can see why he really likes this. It's just this little kid going crazy and then eventually sliding into insane violence.
So I saw your rating on Letterboxd.
Yeah.
But I mean, 2.5 with a heart.
Which, yeah.
And I completely, I agree with that. I think I gave it 3 also with a heart. But what are some of your thoughts?
Well, I mean, we've already kind of discussed that this thing's a mess. I mean, the editing it's been chopped up so much. I'd love to see the 110 minute final cut if it's actually out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tonally, it's just all over the place for me. It was hard for me to kind of gauge where this was going, because it starts off kind of like, this is your life, you know, the kind of upbeat music and all these photos of David's parents in the beginning. It quickly, shifts gears into like a dark tone where it immediately opens up on this dark sky with, you know, the statue outside or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it just kept hopping and hopping to just different things. To me, it felt like an hour and 20 minute movie trailer. Like, I felt like it was just like, these are the scenes that you'll be watching in the movie, and nothing really kind of makes sense. You know, you have to watch the movie to understand what that scene means, mm-hmm. but you don't get any of that when I was watching this. It's just like a fever dream, a collection of like home videos. Like, everything just seemed, I don't know, it was a little overwhelming for me.
Yeah.
But then I embraced it. I gave it 2.5 stars, which means, I mean, usually when I have a 2.5 stars, I'll watch the movie again at some point. Anything below that, I probably won't. Maybe, but but yeah, this one was just, everything felt rushed. And again, I attribute it to the editing, because reading Stephen Thrower's chapter on it, like you said, John, he is completely enamored with this movie.
Yeah.
And he made it sound incredibly interesting. And it is, the post-production, the pre-production, the way it came about, the making of the film is just incredibly more interesting to me than the movie itself.
Yeah.
My first reaction to it was like, this is too much, but I'm glad we're talking about it.
Yeah. And that's kind of the thing here, is it's hard to recommend this as a good film.
Right.
I do think it deserves some sort of spotlight shined on it for what he went through to get it made. This is what happens to your film when you don't have control over it and you let other people in and start fiddling around with it, unfortunately.
Right. I mean, it has a lot of good aspects. I mean, the characters, the acting, there's a lot of really cool scenes that are awesome.
And yeah.
Like, it's worth watching, not just because of, you know, the story of the production, but.
Yeah. I think the kid, I don't like kids, but I think Mark Owens he's good in it. I don't necessarily like his performance as much as Stephen Thrower does, and put it up there as like, this kid should have been a star.
He should have been the next Will Wheaton. Yeah. I could see him and Stand By Me.
Definitely a lot better than a lot of other child actors I've seen in movies. I'll give him that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, emotionally, he definitely goes for it. Like, I think Thrower even points out specifically where he's doing those ritual scenes, like the ceremony to himself, which I totally agree with. Like, that kid really goes for it. He does ugly cry real well.
He does. Very ugly cry. He's competing with Laura Dern. So,
I mean, he's pretty menacing. Leo DiCaprio is another ugly crier. Like, as soon as he was in Gilbert Grape, every other movie after that, he's like, I need a clause that has me ugly crying.
Lance needs a trigger warning for the ugly cry.
Well, I just know if I'm going to watch a Leo DiCaprio movie, he's going to ugly cry or, you know, spit and drool. So at some point, it's just,
Yeah, I think I do like the scenes with Mark when there's some sort of, when he's in the shed with his altar, with the taxidermy Charlie as the centerpiece of that and all the little things that he's got surrounding it. One of the things that a Thrower brings up in his write-up is this idea of nature worship or paganism versus Christianity. And there's that scene where, and he's given the wafer to eat and he just tosses it and says, you know, he's not my father. And it's hard to hear, but I'm glad like you have the write-up of it, because Stephen Thrower points that out specifically. And so I listened for it the second time I watched it, because I didn't remember hearing that
right. The
first time I watched it.
Yeah, again, that was another scene to me that sounded like it was lifted from a trailer. Like, most of those scenes are just like, you kind of have to be on the lookout and hear
what
sounds almost like overdubbed dialogue.
A lot of it does, yeah. It's, every scene is so short. Like, there's no long scenes where you're getting drawn in. You constantly have to reset, because every scene ends abruptly and then starts somewhere else, where the continuity just feels thrown out the window.
Which is funny when I read that he cited Bergman as an influence, where Bergman just like lets that camera sit there and two Swedish people be sad for like 30 minutes at a time.
John.
Aunt yes. Martha. She's a bit of a bitch. I don't know. I mean, it's one of those people that I guess she kind of means well, but just doesn't know how to handle kids, which I can relate to. And I guess it's implied heavily that she was in love with the dad.
Right.
Which I don't know why. The guy was an ivory hunter. You saw all those tusks in those photos. So I'm glad he's dead.
Yeah. Same.
You know. So, but whatever. And I guess like she's taking out like all the pain he put her through on his kid. Could you look at it like that?
I could see that too. Yeah. I liked her portrayal of Aunt Martha. I mean, she is a total bitch. Like
right.
You said. But she's very stoic and matter of fact. And again, it confused me, because there were some scenes where her and David were kind of playing together and it seemed like they have a really good relationship. To me, it's more so like David's the crazy one of the bunch, the kid. But all the adults in here are pretty fucked up. I think Ballard does a really good job of basically setting up all the adults to, you know, want to be the guardian or the father figure and mother figure of this child in a weird way. And like kind of put all their beliefs and, you know, how they handle stuff, kind of train the kid to be who they want him to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's all kind of like a waste of time, because David is like so set and enamored with his dead dad that, you know, this weird, that all these adults that are kind of jealous of each other, you know, pitting against each other, just it's weird. And it goes back to, I wonder what John Ballard's childhood
right,
really like.
Right.
Like what is this all stemming from? Cause that's all, you know, I guess written, and it's not pulled from the original story at all.
Right.
There's nothing about who's David's real mother. Cause I kept asking myself that, is it Mary? Is it Martha? Is, you know, cause I kept thinking Martha was his real mother, because they kept insinuating that she hooked up with his dad.
Right.
And then Mary had the picture of his dad in her locket.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, and then when he kills her, supposedly, you know, he's like, I killed my mother's dead. My mother's dead.
Yeah.
So, I did like that part of the movie where it's very, you can't really tell what's going on. There's so much going on, but at the same time, it's just too much. Like I need some sort of cohesive, I need something here to grab onto, but there's just so much going on.
It's funny. I think all the other adults would have been a better parent figure for the kid than Aunt Martha, who's like the snooty upper class one, you know, like the what's his friend's name? No, the other
Dr. Thompson.
Dr. Thompson.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like you said, yeah, probably putting too much of his own personality into him, trying to raise him the way he wants him. But like, you could already tell from David that like, he's already on that path.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't want to be whoever Aunt Martha wants him to be, some church going good old boy Puritan child.
Yeah, that Dr. Thompson guy is—he's out to party. I mean,
yeah,
he's out to have a good time. I mean, some of his quotes are fucking totally inappropriate, but hilarious. Like when he has that statue of the elephant, and he tells Martha, "Hey, rub the trunk, Martha."
Yeah,
and she's like, "Why?" He's all, "I don't know, just to see what happens." Just.
But David wouldn't be locked up in this giant tomb of a house. He would be going on adventures and stuff. You know,
expeditions.
Yeah, definitely a better surrogate parent than Aunt Martha.
Crazy.
And killed both his pets, one intentionally.
Yeah, that. Yeah, the dog scene, the accidentally killing Henry in the door is terrible.
That's when I knew the kid wasn't coming back. I knew this kid's got bloodlust now.
Yeah. I think, like, just sort of speaking of parental figures, the mom, and one thing that Thrower writes up about this is that the mom's death is barely mourned at all. Mm-hmm. And there's like this, he called it a rejection of the feminine, and that Akeem tells David to remember he is his father's child throughout the movie, and that David's just mourning the loss of his father, not mother. When we see the murder-suicide scene, the father and the mother are having this argument, and she's basically telling the dad, like, hey, you need to be here. You need to stop just going off to Africa. And he's like, oh, been invested in this project for 10 years. I'm like, fuck, what? Cutting off fucking tusks of elephants?
Right.
Fucking project. She accidentally shoots him after she says, well, I'm leaving and I'm taking David with me. So you think that she's got some sort of protective nature, but then after she shoots the father, she turns around and shoots herself. So really, he doesn't have anyone to look up to. I think the best adult in this is Akeem, but he gets sent away by Aunt Martha. But even Akeem is, I don't know what the value is of him teaching him this other sort of African folklore religion.
He just wanted to smoke the kid up. Come on.
Yeah. You know? I mean, he bought him a matching outfit. Yeah. He's like, I gotta give this to somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the short stories, it's an Aztec religion that the kid's really into.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's neat.
But yeah, I mean, I would probably go with Mary, maybe, is the, because she seems to treat him really well, and, you know, kind of wants to interject when Aunt Martha's being such a bitch. But then she kind of loses it and starts, you know, when David's hiding under the bed, that's when he hears her talk kind of bad about him. I think she's so pissed off at Aunt Martha.
I think so too. Like, I don't think she really means it. I think she's just mad that she just got fired.
Right.
Or did she? Because.
Well, yeah. Because Dr. Thompson's like, hey, well, it's just, I'm not going to fix anything for you. Let's just fuck, you know? It's like, that whole scene's so odd.
It is. One of the scenes of speaking of Mary, I like the most, which we find out later didn't actually happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is her death, where she's down in what looks like to be some sort of basement warehouse, hanging sheets all over the place, and she gets killed and stabbed by David, who then tries to blame it on Aunt Martha, saying that she killed her. But he can't even, like, explain it right. Like, he says the wrong name first when he goes to the neighbors to tell
her. Yeah, he says my mother, and yeah.
And that's when I really thought, like, okay, like, when it gets to this point and this death happens, which, you know, she's wrapped up. She gets wrapped up in a white sheet. She's flailing around on the ground, and he's stabbing. It doesn't show his face, but
it's like a black gloved hand, which it's a cool scene.
It is, and that scene gave me hope for the rest of the movie. One of my favorite scenes, but my most favorite is when Charlie quote unquote comes to life and starts attacking Aunt Martha at the end.
Yeah, that scene that I loved. Because, you know, it has Charlie. Also, in the short stories, he doesn't worship a chimpanzee. He worships like it's a real ferret. It's like a polecat ferret.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
That he feeds like berries and stuff. And one of the shorts, the 1981 one I used, he gets like the guts of a dead chicken and feeds it to the parrot with a little poker. And that's who he names Shredni Vashtar, mm-hmm. is the name of the ferret. But yeah, I mean, that the scene where, you know, the chimpanzee kind of comes to life, Charlie, and starts kind of attacking Martha.
Yeah.
I love that scene, but I also love that creepy orphanage dream scene he has at the end.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Where it's like he's, So Aunt Martha goes to Dave and she's like, oh, I'm going to get you the orphanage catalog and show you this place. I think you'll like it. You know, basically you're going.
Right.
And I guess he kind of passes out, but he has this vision. It's this really scene of this rundown, creepy orphanage. It's like a madhouse for children where they're all kind of walking around and they're all like, you know, it's like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, all these little like Danny DeVito's walking around. Like. and then Aunt Martha is the doctor and she has a fake mustache and these big glasses off and she rips the mustache off, takes the glasses off. And it's like, okay, let's cut his tongue out. And they cut his tongue out, which I love that scene.
It reminds me of the, remember when Geraldo Rivera did like the expose on mental institutions in the 80s and like he just like went in with a camera and everybody's just like shitting on the floor. And it's really crazy, really like gross, but like disturbing.
Yeah. And I thought like that scene was kind of where you were. I was like, oh, okay, this is badass.
Yeah.
But that was like the last 5 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, exactly. Like it has these scenes that are really great, but they're in a movie that is so tonally inconsistent and all over the place that it's really hard to get
right.
Hold of it, so.
Well, what's really funny about this is that, even though I read Nightmare USA a lot as a kid, well, not a kid, it came out in my 20s, but whatever.
Yeah.
I never read the chapter on this one because I would always see the movie first before I'd read it. Cause I, you know, I'm like that about spoilers. So I knew it was Friday the 13th, The Orphan. And I figured, okay, it was originally The Orphan, but they retitled it Friday the 13th, The Orphan later to cash in on Friday the 13th. So I always imagined it was like a proto slasher. So when I watched it with you, it was nothing what I was expecting.
I mean, it tries to sell itself like that too, because if you see the key art, like it's got a knife with blood in it,
right?
Stabbing a calendar with Friday the 13th on it, and that's
there's the servant lady's murder sequence, which is all the good stuff's like at the last 10 minutes. All like they need to really find a way to smear it throughout the whole thing. But what's really funny though is that the disjointed kind of flavor of the movie felt intentional to me. When I read that it was like butchered, I was kind of surprised. Like it kind of does give it that hazy, disturbed kid going from like one thought to the other kind of style. And
One thing that I felt like it did intentionally was the setup of right away, you know, the parents are killed, but you don't know how. And they keep showing scenes. And then, you know, I guess it's about halfway through the movie, you realize it's a murder-suicide.
Right.
And that was interesting, but said, John, it's very disjointed and you're like, is this intentional? Like that felt intentional to me, but everything else was just like
even
editing.
The funeral in the very beginning feels really weird. Like it's cool. It feels like something out of Messiah of Evil or something.
Yeah.
And it's like dreamy and bizarre POV.
Yeah.
But
telling him to kiss his father.
Yeah. It's like very nightmarish, but then it just goes into just, let's follow this kid around for a bit and not know what's real or not.
Yeah.
The editing is structurally jarring. And I feel like if we really want to show this kid descending into madness and reaching a breaking point, then the scenes that involve him can have that element to it. But when you have other scenes with just, you know, adults chatting or whatever, and Mark not interacting with anyone, have those play out normally, but they don't. And it's so all over the place. And I can see it being something chopped to pieces. I can also see it being something edited this way purposefully, but either way, it doesn't really quite work for me.
But it's all in his POV, right? Like even when other characters are talking, like it's sort of like you see him eavesdropping.
Yeah. I'm wondering if maybe originally it was leaning more towards that. And that's why I think it is kind of choppy. Cause I know some of the deleted scenes in Stephen Thrower's book, I think it was a scene of, well, it's briefly in the movie of him looking in and I think it's Mary, the servant, she's taking a shower.
It's super weird.
It's like, why is this here?
Yeah.
And like, there's even like this, again, like it's kind of like a dubbing voice, but it's like, oh, I think he saw you, you know, it's just very weird.
And it's in the middle of like the dinner scene. Like she just took a shower in the middle of dinner.
It was just on her dress, but so Stephen Thrower's got a short section on missing scenes. And Ballard said, I was forced to remove a scene where Martha sees Mary showering and fantasizes first that the girl is making love with a man in the shower and then that she herself is in the shower with a man. So the way that it's edited now, it looks like Mark is the one peeping on her and yeah, then David. Mary, and then Martha catches him. But then they don't show her watching her. So
yeah, again, that scene was
why is Martha in there with her when she's taking a shower?
Another cut scene that I had read about is that Martha gives Akeen a blowjob.
Yeah, there is. So that was the second one he mentioned. Quote: There is a scene in which Peggy Fury has an erotic fantasy about Afolabi Ajayi. She goes to his cabin and has oral sex, where we see her going down on his stomach. But then Ballard said, I didn't mind that being taken out.
I know, because there is that weird scene where, you know, she's asking him to leave and she's like, here's some money. And then she very awkwardly says something like, is there anything else you need from me? Or something like that. Right. I bet that's part of that fantasy scene.
Right.
That was cut.
I think so too.
Wait, Martha or Mary? Martha?
Aunt Martha.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Martha.
She's all over the place.
Yeah, but she dropped some racism too.
Yeah, there is.
Oh, wow. Racism. So she's got one of those kinks.
Yeah.
That's a different kind of BDSM.
Yeah. One of the deleted scenes that interested me the most was a dream sequence. He said, quote, we start off with a lamp and a moth circling the bulb. David reaches for it, gets a shock, looks at his hand, and sees all of these ants pouring out of his palm and up his forearm. So he rubs them off, and as he's rubbing his arm comes off. He doesn't know what to do, and he's frantic, so he runs into the bathroom, and that's where he starts flushing his clothes down the toilet.
That sounds amazing.
Oh, I remember him flushing the clothes down the toilet.
That's when he's dressed up as...
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah, it's frustrating to, like, read what this could have been.
Right.
It's funny because man-eating ants are like a thing in Africa. My friend's dad saw a movie like when he was really young, and it took place in Africa. And it's not like a horror movie, but it's just one scene where like this guy's tied to a tree and ants are eating him alive. And it's just wedged in his brain. And then one day he went out in the woods and he found this like a log that was covered in ants, and he had to flee the woods because it's just like flashback to that scene.
Like you said, I feel like there's film out there for an amazing sounding movie. Like all these cut scenes and how it was kind of butchered in editing by those two women.
Mm-hmm.
That sounded very like accusatory. Those women.
I mean,
yeah,
that's who they were.
I sound like David talking about Aunt Martha.
The woman moved in.
Well, in a sense, it's the movie's symbolic to its release, where it's like, yeah, my dad was taking care of me, and this lady shows up and fucks everything up.
Right.
All right, so John, I know you were like kind of about it.
I know people who would really enjoy this movie, though. So it has its merit, but it's not for me. I mean, it's not fair that I was expecting like a proto slasher, like The Redeemer or something.
Sure.
So like, and I didn't get that, but maybe a few years from now, knowing exactly what it is and I revisit it. Yeah. Or even if it's this version, but in like gets an official release that looks like I can look at it.
With like an audio commentary or something from Ballard. Cause like, again, that's most of the interesting aspects.
Yeah.
But we watch some VHS rip on YouTube.
I mean,
yeah. Like,
what would you do for a double feature with this movie?
Mine would be Carrie.
Nice.
You got the absent father, the domineering parent figure, kid gone crazy. I feel like there was a few other things that's leaving my mind right now.
The religious.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And the fact that you're just like, and like trying to make the kid into something that they're not, like, you know, obviously Carrie does not want to be some Jesus freak. And this kid does not want to be some snooty upper class kid. And I think it would be a good double feature. It would be like a 7-inch where like Carrie would be like the hit single on the A side and the Orphan would be like this lesser known B side, you know, that'll be it.
So I went with the idea that stuck with me because I recently watched Manhunter, Michael Mann's.
I love that movie so much.
Too.
Yeah. I watch it twice a year.
It's brilliant. And as I was watching it, I kept thinking Francis Dolarhyde could be David grown up. So I kind of went with the, like, looking into what would David be like as an adult. Mm-hmm. And I stepped away from Manhunter because that's, you know, that needs to stand alone. Just watch that, you know, twice in one night. You don't need another movie.
Well, did you see the shitty Red Dragon with Edward Norton?
I haven't seen that.
Okay, it's shitty, but they go into Francis Dolarhyde's...
childhood?
Yes, and it's exactly like The Orphan.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, he's raised by his grandmother who treats him like shit and...
Well, there's a lot of and you know, Francis Dolarhyde, he puts the mirrors on his victim's eyes and stuff. And David has an infatuation with mirrors because his dad's like, what I wrote down a quote, said, watch and hear inside the mirror.
Yeah.
Don't forget me. And he's like, I won't forget you, Dad. You know, so I kind of went with that. Maybe I should stick with Manhunter.
I mean, that can be your backup recommendation.
Yeah.
The case for it. I do want to hear what you were going to go with, though.
I kept thinking of how, you know, envisioning David growing up. So I went with Cub from 2014,
I remember that. Yeah, I seen that.
I saw it at Fantastic Fest, I guess the premiere in 2014.
Okay. Was it French or Spanish?
I can't remember. French.
French
and Dutch, I think. But it's directed by, I guess his name's Jonas Govaerts. If I'm saying that right, but it's about a bunch of Cub Scouts and they head out to the woods for a weekend getaway. And there's this kind of campfire, scary story that they tell of this wildling, like this little boy who lives in the woods, who basically kills people. Mm-hmm. And there's also an adult in the woods with a kid. And this is who I envision Dave growing up to be. He's like this creepy, really big guy. He doesn't have a whole lot of dialogue. Mm-hmm. Maybe a few lines at all, but usually it's just kind of in the background and the kid's doing his bidding, like killing stuff. But I envision him like recruiting and kind of indoctrinating these young kids with his own kind of hybrid, like religion of woods and animals and stuff. And the lead character is this one Cub Scout named Sam, who's a foster kid. And apparently he had a violent past and is kind of fucked up. So there's similarities with him and David too. But my kind of focus is what would David grow up to be? And so I went with Cub. It's really fast paced. It's like, I think it's like The Orphan, which is under 85 minutes or something, 83 minutes. And it has an amazing score from Steve Moore. If you guys know him, above the prog band Zombie, which I love. But yeah, it's streaming on Tubi and Shudder. So Cub with Manhunter is my backup.
I haven't seen it since it came out, but I remember there's one scene with like a big truck and a bunch of sleeping kids that you might like. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a really,
tent, yeah.
Yeah. So. And there's a really mean dog death in it.
There is a mean dog death. And that kind of, I guess that aspect, it's the kid, it's the crazy kid that kind of does it.
Yeah.
That kind of steps away from David's, you know, from the orphan. It doesn't seem like he would hurt animals, but yeah, there is that very uncomfortable scene, but the tent scene.
Add to the list.
Yeah. I forgot all about that movie.
All right. So my double feature pick is, I kind of feel kind of along the lines of John's. It feels like it might be like a basic, maybe not obvious pick, but a little bit more mainstream. So I'm going with The Fly 2.
Mm.
So you've got an orphan, essentially. His dad was shot by his mom.
right.
That's true.
He's trying to sort of figure out who he is, although he's growing up in this sort of also secluded environment, albeit clinical versus pastoral.
Yeah. And I mean, his caretakers are big assholes too.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's kind of where the similarities end, but I also I haven't watched The Fly 2 since I was a kid, and rewatching it, I was like, this is a good movie.
they kill his dog in The Fly 2 as well.
That's true.
Yeah.
Oh shit.
Yeah.
There's another connection. See?
There's a lot of dead dogs going on.
Yeah.
Features.
We've been watching a lot of dead dogs recently.
The cat lived in that Born for Hell movie we watched.
Yes.
Yeah. We watched some Richard Speck based movie where it's like this guy's butchering a bunch of women in this apartment, but they have a cat. And the whole time me and Eric are on the edge of our seat watching the cat. Yes. He's taking these ladies one by one. I'm like, okay, is the cat still okay?
Yes. It's a mean movie, but...
Very mean.
Yeah.
Very mean.
All right, so Lance, next pick.
Next pick. My next pick is Hellhole from 1985. It was first released in Italy in 84, apparently, okay. But 1985, directed by Pierre Del Moro. What's it about? It's about a young woman witnesses her mother's murder and is injured and so traumatized by the event, she loses her memory and is committed to a mental institution, which is what you do with people with amnesia, right?
Of course, of course.
And as she's trying to settle into the madhouse as a patient, the man who killed her mother, the sleazy, horny guy named Silk, infiltrates the institution and poses as a doctor to get to the young woman. But this is the least of everyone's worries because the asylum is being run by a psychotic scientist using the helpless inmates as guinea pigs in experimental chemical lobotomies, which is conducted in the hellhole. And the crazy doctor, by the way, of these horrible experiences, played by Mary fucking Warnoff.
Ah, your favorite.
So that's the main reason for my pick. Sure. So we get to talk about her a whole episode.
What a bad week for that girl. God, mom's butchered. You get amnesia. The killer's after you. And then you're in some mental institution.
It's a fucking trip.
Does it sound kind of like a woman in prison?
It's labeled a horror woman in prison. So you're going to get, you know, cat fights and you're going to get some murdering going on.
Have you seen this one?
I've seen the first 20 minutes of it. I've seen the slasher movie beginning.
Okay.
Me and Ryan watched it, but it was like 4 a.m. So we just passed out, but we were vibing on it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's on Tubi. And Shout Factory released a Blu-ray under Screen Factory, but it has 655 views on Letterboxd. Hellhole, 1985.
Sick.
All right, John, where can people find, follow, do all the things for Twitch of the Death Nerve?
You can find us on Instagram as Twitch of the Death Nerve Podcast, and you can find me on Letterboxd as Funereality, and that's all I'm at.
So everyone, be sure to check out Twitch of the Death Nerve if you haven't already. I know quite a few of our listeners already do listen. If you're not already, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and Slasher, all at Unsung Horrors. You can follow me on Letterboxd, Twitter, and Instagram at Hex Massacre. And Lance?
You can follow me at Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at L Scheibe. Yeah, I have a Big Cartel store, lancescheibe.bigcartel.com. And I am adding new Unsung Horrors enamel pins.
Yes.
So it's our logo. They turned out really great. It's a logo which was designed by my twinsie, Cody. But if you are interested in these pins, check it out. If you like them, be sure to enter Unsung Horrors, all caps, all one word, to get 25% off your order. And yeah, we're excited about it because I think they turned out great.
Yeah, they look great. We'll also be including one of those in our prize package for this year's Horror Gives Back challenge. That'll have some movies, maybe a book or two, some pins, probably some other goodies in there as well. So the giveaway for that is for people who participate, and by participate, I mean donate, not, you know, you don't have to follow our list. Again, putting that out there. So again, if you are interested in getting the list early, before we post it, you can message us and we'll send that to you. But otherwise, be on the lookout for that. And we'll see you back next episode for Hellhole.
Yes. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Night.
Now I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this: the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah. You say I took the name in vain. I don't even know the name. But if I did, well, really, what's it to you? There's a blaze of light in every word. It doesn't matter which you heard, the holy or the broken. Hallelujah.
Hey, it's Death by Video.
I'm Phil.
I'm Kit.
And I'm Graham, saying welcome to our podcast full of merry movie mayhem.
Ever wonder what an Irish kung fu movie would look like?
It's called Fatal Deviation, and we covered it.
Ever wonder what a movie about 1,000 cats would look like?
It's called Night of 1,000 cats, and we covered it.
And it stars Hugo Stiglitz. Listen to Death by Video to hear us discuss and dissect some of the weirdest, wildest, and wackiest films ever made. All this and more on Death by Video!
Woo!